News 101.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
Right.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. Always glad to get your calls. And our poll on X today, is our government right to label those of us who call ourselves pro-life, and that would include me, as terrorists? And my answer to that is no. You can answer any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And it's always brought to you by AMAC. Go to AMAC.us. Let me go back to the calls. Dave's on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Lars, one of our board members at Climate Change Truth is of Hispanic. Lives in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And the fallacy of Democrats is that these people coming across the border will become Democrats because 90% of them are Catholic. And Catholics will not go to a party that pushes abortion. And he told me this a long time ago, and it's true. All of his friends, everybody of his family, anybody they know that came over the border, they all register Republicans.
Well, that's a nice theory to have. Can I bust it up a little bit for you?
Sure.
Okay. I thought on paper, Hispanics would be just as you did, would be conservatives and hence Republicans. It has not worked out that way. There are today of people who live in the United States and are Hispanic, 28% are Republicans. 28%. Now you say, well, why then would you expect, number one, why would you expect the largely Hispanic crowd of illegal aliens who've come in the last 3 years, so about 11 million people, why would they end up voting for Joe Biden? And I gave you that example at the top. When reporters go down to the border and they say, who do you want to see win the election in November in America? Because you're coming into America. And they say, we want Joe to win because Joe will let us in. He'll not only let you in, he'll give you an airplane ticket. He'll arrange to have an airplane ticket given to you. The big Democrat cities will give you a debit card full of cash. They'll put you up at a hotel. So here's what's going to happen. The short-term needs of you and your family. You've left a country somewhere, not because you were fleeing persecution. In almost all cases, you will be denied asylum. Who's going to let you stay? That would be Joe Biden. Who's going to tell you you've got to leave? That would be Donald Trump. So at least in the short run, you're going to see the people coming in illegally, if they're allowed to vote, and they're going to try, and I'll give you some evidence of that, and they probably will be successful in some cases, even though as a foreign national, they have absolutely no right to vote in our elections. But they're going to look, who gave us entry to America? Joe Biden. Who gave us a free airplane ticket? Joe Biden. Who gave us a free hotel?
Let me go ahead. Bust that up a little bit. Okay, so the ones that come in that stay in Texas are definitely Republicans. When they move to a liberal city, then they change.
I don't think so.
I know. Oh, no, I've been there, and I know that for a fact, and so does he.
Well, except when I look at the overall numbers, Dave, how do you explain the fact that only 28% of registered of Hispanic Americans are registered Republicans? And that includes people who don't have to worry about getting tossed out of the country. These are, for the most part, American citizens or legal resident aliens, and only 28% of them are Republicans. If your theory was right, we should see 85-90% Republican registration among Hispanics, and yet that's not what the numbers are right now.
Is that, but are those numbers based on national or just in Texas?
No, those are the national numbers. 28%
That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Texas. What they do after there, go to a liberal city, they're going to get their minds changed, of course. But when they come in, If they register to vote in Texas, they register as Republicans. I know that for a fact. When they move to other states, yeah, like Oregon, of course they do, because these are giving them all kinds of freebies and stuff.
I'm just going to tell you something. That over the years, the Democrats have treated illegal aliens and legitimate Hispanic residents of the United States as a given, that they always get the votes they're planning on getting. I was trying to see if I could find a Texas number, but I can't find one for Hispanics. But I'm telling you, the people who are already here who are Hispanic and are citizens or legal residents are not registered as Republicans for the most part. 28% are nationwide. And what I'm telling you is they're going to be right now, the ones who've just come in are going to identify with Joe Biden because Joe is who let them in. Joe is who gave them the freebies. Donald Trump has said, no, if you're not here legally, I'm going to make you leave. That alone is going to be a major factor. And despite that, Hispanic Americans are now shifting. The voters are. Hispanic voters are shifting over to Trump because they see the danger that's posed. And I understand, Dave, I used to make the argument. I would ask questions of experts in elections. I'd say, why is it that if most Hispanic Americans are hardworking, family-oriented, pro-life, church-going, and they want to keep their paychecks, why are they not voting Republican? And it's because the Democrats have always done a good job of selling themselves as we're the party that goes out and does things for minority citizens. And the Hispanic Americans bought that line for a long, long time.
Yes, they did.
They're starting to shift over to the Republican side. But the brand newest people, these 11 million who've come in, and let me tell you the story. I said I'd back up the idea that they're going to try to get votes out of these 11 million illegals who, we can agree, have no right under law to vote in an American election as they are not citizens. They are not here legally, so they cannot vote. And yet, consider this. In Texas, since the start of this year, so in the last 4 months, what have they seen? The federal laws allow you to register to vote even if you don't have a photo ID. Now, I don't know how many people in this country, even the poorest person in this country, has a photo ID. Why? To be able to drive a car, to be able to open a bank account, to be able to cash their paycheck, to be able to do just about anything, to rent an apartment. You, for the most part, have to have a photo ID. So what has happened in the first 4 months of this year? The Social Security Administration says 1,250,000 people have registered in Texas since the first of this year. They've registered to vote, and they did it without a photo ID. Now, why are they allowed to do that?
Terrible.
The Democrats got a law passed. They said, you've got to make it easy to vote. Well, it should be easy to vote and hard to cheat. If you walked into a polling place and said, I want to vote, I don't have any photo ID. I don't have any photo ID. Now, Dave, even the poorest person who's working paycheck to paycheck needs photo ID to be able to navigate through life. I mean, to be able to cash a check, a paycheck. Say you don't have a bank account. How do you cash your paycheck? You pull out your photo ID. Anyway, Dave, it's an interesting argument. I don't necessarily buy it. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
If you're the same.
He's up before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and always a pleasure to welcome back Sarah Parshall Perry, who's a legal fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at Heritage Foundation. You know, this is one of the subjects, Sarah, that has just confounded me. I don't understand why the medical community, other than money, other than just the love of money, why they're willing to mutilate so many kids when there is, it seems now, less and less science to back up any of this nonsense about the proper treatment of a gender-confused child is either to chemically castrate that child, or if it's a girl, medically or chemically stop puberty and maybe even do a double mastectomy. It just sounds like that is not the solution to this problem. And now we seem to be seeing the end of this thing, right? Maybe.
Well, I'm hoping so, because actually within the span of 10 days, two very significant studies were just released. The first one was just released today. The entirety of the findings were just released by British pediatrician Dr. Hilary Kass. Now, let me tell you a little something about Dr. Kass. She is actually the former president of the Royal College of Pediatrics. So she is an exceptionally well-respected researcher. She was approached in 2019 by the National Health Service, the NHS, in England to commission essentially a study of over 9,000 gender dysphoric individuals who had gone through this medical transition process. And what she discovers was absolutely damning. In fact, she opens with a statement that the entire gender medicine industry is built on, quote, shaky foundations. She urged extreme caution when using cross-sex hormones or puberty blockers, and eliminated the entirety of the call to surgically intervene with these gender dysphoric minors as well, because in the disproportionate number of cases, these 9,000 individuals were actually not only dealing with comorbid mental health diagnoses that were misdiagnosed as gender dysphoria, but that many of them had comorbid diagnoses of neurodevelopmental delays like autism spectrum disorder. It is truly one of the most damning reports I think the entire gender medicine industry has been subjected to yet.
And yet they've got billions of dollars at their fingertips. In the last couple of years, I think the number 2 years ago was $2 billion, maybe three last year, $5 billion by next year. There's a lot of money and there are a lot of reputations on the line. And don't I recall that there was a Canadian psychiatrist, and I think it was a young lady, who came out a couple of years ago and said, you're seeing a tremendous number of autistic individuals. And they said one of the attributes of autism is that you have a really tough time fitting in. That you're not accepted very well. But if you announce I'm transgender, boom, all of a sudden you got friends all over the place. And that might actually have been the transgender, industry, if you will, saying all you got to do is say you're transgender and all of a sudden everybody in the world's going to take you in. And that seems like a really cruel psychological trick to play on somebody with a disability.
Absolutely. And in fact, her studies published in the Journal of Sexual Behavior actually confirmed what Dr. Kass just revealed today, which is the significant cohort of individuals who were on the autism spectrum, who are dealing with other underlying comorbidities that are significant mental health or developmental diagnoses, disorders that have been churned through the gender medicine machine. And as you rightly pointed out, this is a multi-billion with a B industry, dollar industry a year. This is functionally something that is equivalent to a social experiment. And that's exactly what Dr. Kass called it, saying that we have absolutely no idea what the long-term effects are. And even when she tried to ask questions of the two gender clinics in England, the doors were slammed in her face because it is so politicized that no one even wants to have an open, functional debate about this. It's actually astonishing.
Well, two other things that I wanted to ask you about. One, I don't know if you know this or not, but where our main studios are is Portland, Oregon, which is where the Oregon Health and Science University is. And they have been going hammer and tong at this. But one of their stars is this Dr. Blair Peters, who is bizarre individual to be at a major medical teaching college and university hospital. And we've run sound bites from this video that was actually, I think, shown to the Congress, in which he says, we're kind of figuring it out as we go along. And I thought, if I took any child to any doctor for any reason and you said, my granddaughter, she's sick. Can you do something? Well, yeah, we can do this. You'd say, well, will that work? Well, I don't know. We're kind of figuring it out as we go along. I would run out of that office so fast. You couldn't imagine. And they're basing all of this on people who say, yeah, we're figuring it out while we go along. How in the world did we get to this point?
Well, then on top of that, you add the release to Michael Schellenberger, the release of the WPATH transgender medicine files. That's the World Professional Association of Transgender Health. And they literally are caught on camera saying, we are not getting informed consent. We have to cut the parents out of the equation. We know these are money-making surgeries. The entire house of cards seems precariously and tantalizingly close to falling down. And that is truly my hope and prayer. It follows on the heels of a Dutch study of 2017.
Oh, I was going to go there next, Sarah. You and I think alike.
Over 15 years. Yes, we do. And I have to tell you, the Dutch study came out and said, listen, 78% of these kids are going to get to a point where they make complete peace with their natal sex. Shock and awe. Puberty is a difficult time period for everyone. It is the first long-term study, the first cohort over 15 years of 2,700 children, both who came into it with absolutely no expression of gender dysphoria and some who did. And it is, of course, in total confirmation of what we have always known, that these young children are experiencing very normal, awkward, pubertal development, and to leave them alone is the best approach.
I mean, awkward is in the dictionary right next to the word puberty, isn't it? I mean, the whole process is tough for, and everybody knows it. We've all been through it. But this idea that, to put it in layman's terms, Sarah, forgive me for doing this, Sarah Parshall Perry is a legal fellow at the Mies Center, they'll grow out of it in 8 out of 10 cases, right?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly it. And again, that argues for watchful waiting, which is what Dr. Cass has also recommended as the bottom line clinical recommendations. And again, this is a significantly large, long-term, broad-scale study. She was commissioned back in 2019. She has been working on this report for 5 years. So I'm already starting to see blowback on Twitter about the fact that she's some kind of a medical hack. But again, she was approached.
Hold on, she's a medical hack, but she's at the she has all these major credentials, but she's a medical hack.
Right. Former president of the Royal College of Pediatrics in London, commissioned by their federal government to actually conduct this study. And I think what she discovered was absolutely damning. It has proven so far to be very activating on Twitter. And my hope is really that this is sort of the cherry on top, that we start to see things entirely fall apart for an entire industry that's funded and fueled by not only money, but incredibly invective political discourse.
Sarah, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and this is why. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Lars.
That is Sarah Parshall Perry from the Heritage Foundation. And this, I just hope that the people in the medical community will take this to heart, have a come to Jesus, and say this stuff has got to stop, and it's got to stop now.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Whenever you want it, get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's become something I've expected to see almost every single week. A brand new horrendous crime committed again by illegal aliens allowed in just in the last 3 years by Joseph R. Biden. Over an open borders, and I've been trying to persuade people this is going to create not just today, but it's going to create an ongoing issue of crimes against Americans, sometimes rape, sometimes murder, and we can cite specific examples of that. And many of the examples you probably will never hear about, because much of the legacy media will do stories about somebody who's suffered a rape, been the victim of a rape, or been the victim of a murder. And the story will not at all mention, if they can possibly avoid it, the fact that the suspect or the person accused is in fact in the country illegally, because that would run counter to certain other political goals that much of the media has. So I wanted to talk to Jonathan E. Mord, who's a constitutional law attorney and the author most recently of The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from 19th Century to Present. Jonathan, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Ars.
How much are we going to be able to, how much do you think Americans are going to tolerate before they absolutely demand change of this open border? And let me cite one more data point. That is, just in the last 2 days, we've seen a brand new Harris poll, which I think is, I look at the reputation of the pollsters as we get them, and there's some that I think, oh, they tilt to the left, tilt to the right, or they're mostly down the middle. Harris says that a majority of Americans, 51%, favor mass deportation of illegals, and that includes 46% of Democrats. Have we finally reached the breaking point for Americans where they've seen what 3.5 years of an open border will do to the country?
Yes, I think so. I think people are fed up with this planned destruction of the United States, and that's exactly what this is. They're not only opening the border and letting anyone come into this country, including enemies of the United States, agents of those enemies, drug traffickers, sex traffickers, MS-13, 18th Street gang members, and terrorists, but they're also incentivizing their entry by giving them welfare, food stamps, cash, free cell phones at our expense, and tickets to go wherever they want, paid by NGOs that are 100% taxpayer-payer funded. So this is a disgrace. It is a planned ruination of our country, and people are fed up with it. We probably have some 20 to 30 million illegal aliens in this country who form a massive underground economy. They can't work legally, and so they work illegally with below minimum wages. They are taking away jobs from legal immigrants, and they're taking away jobs from American citizens. And at the same time, we have this massive criminal enterprise that the cartels are supporting inside the United States, drug trafficking and sex trafficking. I represent two families whose daughters were sex trafficked within the Fairfax County public school system. One was 12 years old in Herndon Middle School. And she was, and that's a case, again, of an illegal alien boy who is in the MS-13 gang, and he seduced this girl. He's in the school himself, and she was sex trafficked for over a year, and right through the school system. And this is the threat, and this is the danger, and it's absolutely real, and it's becoming ubiquitous. And I think people have had it.
Do you think, though, that the folks, I mean, on the president's side, on Biden's side, are looking at this and realizing we have to change? And I'd cite, there was a letter sent by five Democrats either this week or last week demanding that the president, and these are Democrats asking Joe Biden to put Title 42 back in place, and that he start enforcing federal law, and that the expulsion authority that CBP had until it expired last year be renewed. Is this a sign that even the left-wingers on the Democrat side of the aisle are saying this is too much, and we're going to lose the American people over this?
Well, the left-wingers who are in control of this administration, who really have our whole nation being held hostage, have no interest whatsoever in ending this. It's part of a greater globalist objective, which is to basically destroy the security that we have so that we will accept government control. You know, it's a sad reality, but if you put all the pieces together, there's no question but that this is an intended destruction. This isn't something that's incidental or mistaken. They actually do understand fully what's happening, and they do not care one whit about the effects on the American citizen, except, as Rahm Emanuel said during the Biden or the Obama years, you never let a crisis go to waste. Well, in those days, they used to wait for a crisis. Well, now they create the crisis, and they're taking full advantage of it.
Jonathan, what's the end game? In other words, I understand the Democrats could say, why, this is going to be a new dependent class of residents, not citizens. We will be able to make it possible for them to vote, and there appears to be very much a plan to do that. And that federal law, to some extent, allows them to do it. Arizona has said you can't register to vote in a state election, but we will let you register to vote under the motor voter to vote in federal elections. Well, that's what most of the national DNC wants, is they want the votes from the national election. And Arizona demands its own residents prove citizenship to vote. But they're saying if you just want to vote for Joe and a Democrat for the U.S. Senate, we'll let you do that. And we'll make it happen.
Yes, it very definitely has an effect, is in their interest to try to break down the integrity of the election process so that illegals can vote, and they certainly are trying to do that. But the bigger picture, really, is that they don't care at all what happens to the American citizen. They don't care if your life is taken. In these instances, like this poor child that was raped by this Honduran illegal immigrant who was released by Steve Descano, who is a Rosebach prosecutor in Fairfax County. He won't prosecute any sex trafficking cases. He doesn't do it.
Why?
And so
what does he use as an excuse? How does he excuse that?
Well, they like to think that the
LionsClubs.org to find a local Lions Club near you.
To all the wokey snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's going to be hard for me to understand how any Democrats who usually talk about women's rights, among other things, how any of them could vote for Joe Biden, because Joe Biden's government has now changed the definitions in what is known as Title IX. Title IX's basic aim was to make sure that young women got the same opportunities, educationally speaking, as young men did, both in sports and in education itself. And yet now with the change in Title IX, well, any young man who identifies as a woman will be able to compete against biological women and in many cases beat them. And I think that's going to take a lot of the opportunities away from young women. I thought we'd talk about that with our friend Ryan Walters, who's the Oklahoma State School Superintendent and a former U.S. history teacher. I would imagine if you're writing the history book on this one, Ryan, that it's going to be interesting to look back 10 or 20 years from now and say, do you remember when we tried that crazy idea that any woman could be replaced by a man who called himself a woman, and we let them get away with it for a while? Because I don't think it's going to last.
It's pretty crazy, Lars. You know, I was on the phone with superintendents from around the country earlier today to talk through this and talk about our next steps, you know, and it's such a level of absurdity. That if it wasn't so dangerous, it would be laughable. But the forcing states to put boys and girls bathrooms, boys and girls sports, and just spitting in the face of, you know, I told you before, I've got a young daughter, the oldest is, I got two young daughters, the oldest is 9, and she's a tennis player. You know, she's worked really hard, she's getting better and better, and takes lessons, all that kind of stuff. I mean, to imagine, to let that girl grow up, work hard, you take up for women, you take up for women's rights, you try to protect young girls, her to get into the senior tennis tournament and have some boy stand across the net against her and whoop her. I mean, it's all of her hard work, all that dedication goes for what? And it's just absurd that Democrats believe that's a winning issue for them. That's the only thing I can see this as, is they are appeasing the most radical elements of their base. This doesn't pass the sniff test. I've told you, Lars, I go around the state every week, and I talk Republicans, Democrats, Independents, all the above. And this is an issue that they always come back to. Everybody from all backgrounds going, I'm saying people have lost their mind. They think the Democrat Party's lost their mind. And I'm telling you, for Joe Biden to push this radicalism in this country, that we've never seen anything like this level of radical.
What happens when the first young lady, girl in public school says, I am being forced by my school that if I want to participate in some sport, whatever it is, I have to share the locker room and the shower room with a biological male, and you, the government, are intruding on my privacy in that way. Is that not going to happen? Because I guess I could imagine a lawsuit like that. And if I sat on the jury, I'd say, yeah, you made her share a locker room and a changing room and a shower room with a young man. You have seriously compromised her right to privacy. And I can't imagine the courts not deciding she's the victim and the schools are going to end up paying the cost, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. And look, I think we've got, you know, we're working on a lawsuit against the feds on this right now. You know, we're going to continue to work to stand up for common sense and the rights of the individual. But the reality is yeah, they're trying. They know this can't really hold muster. But what they're trying to do is intimidate, bully, and weaponize the government where, you know, Lars, this happens all the time here. I've told you about it across the country, but even in a red state, we'll have these atheist law firms that come in and sue our schools and say, hey, take down Bible verses off the wall. And I'm going, well, you can have a Bible verse on a wall. I mean, if it's part of the lesson, why in the world could you do something like that? And no, I mean, the schools just respond to it. So what they're hoping is that everybody just backs down to it and just does as they're told. We're not going to do that. We're going to fight back in Oklahoma. I know a lot of our red states are going to continue to fight back as well. But that's the one thing you can't let them do. You can't let them get away with this kind of nonsense by just backing down to it.
Well, let me ask you this, because, Ryan, one of the challenges I've had from listeners who I don't think have thought through four or five chess moves ahead is they say, why don't those young ladies just say, I'm not playing on the team or I'm not playing that match if I'm playing against a biological male? And I said, because I think a lot of them are like your daughter. They've invested years of their time and effort. They know mom and dad have invested as well. And if you walk in and say, I'm going to quit, they'll be allowed to quit. It won't change a darn thing. And they will take all of that hard work they've put in, effort and money and everything else, and it'll just be flushed down the drain and they'll have no opportunities at all. And I think that's the reason that we're seeing so many young women athletes who I can't believe think this is fair, say, well, but I'll accept it because standing up and objecting to it will either get me kicked off the team or I'll be forced to quit the team. And then I lose all my opportunities altogether.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. And, you know, and it's just a sad state of affairs when you look at this and go, we're the adults. You know, the adult and kids aren't supposed to have to throw away their entire athletic career because the adults have lost their minds. You know, what happened to a day and time when the adults actually look out for kids? You know, they're kids. You know, they are not fully formed adults yet. So we're supposed to be the ones that go, hey, guys, like, I get some of you are confused, but we're not putting boys and girls sports, okay? That's not the way this is going to work. Like, we are not going to back down to an absurd ideology, but the adults have done that, and now we're looking at the kids going, well, you know, can you guys stand up on this? And I'm going, man, isn't it sad that we're putting that responsibility on the kids instead of being the adults and saying, guys, this should never happen. We should never watch a girl say, so I'm just going to, you know, quit on the sport that I love because the adults have decided boys are now girls. I mean, it's just really sad what we're doing to these young ladies.
Absolutely right. That's Ryan Walters from Oklahoma, the state school superintendent. Ryan, thanks very much. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls. You got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a Tuesday, and it's a pleasure to be with you, and always a pleasure to welcome back to the program our friend Dr. Henry Miller, a medical doctor, molecular biologist, the Glenn Swagger Distinguished Fellow at the American Council on Science and Health. He is the founding director, or was the founding director, of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology. Doc, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Lars, as always.
So what's on your agenda tonight?
Well, I was going to talk about the difference in types of viruses that determine whether they can be eradicated from the community or whether we can just try to control them. It's an interesting issue, and you know, I'm fascinated by viruses. I worked on them for many, many years.
So which approach is, I mean, I suppose if you could say we've eliminated it altogether, but then again, we thought we had eliminated a number of diseases from America, and now, thanks to some border policies, they seem to be back. So is it better just to say we're going to control it than to try to eliminate it and then just find it popping back up because the rest of the world kind of runs on the Wild West theory?
Well, the viruses, in effect, get a vote here. So let me explain what I mean. There are viruses that have long incubation periods and short incubation periods. And the incubation period is the time from when a person is exposed until symptoms begin. So the virus takes a while to get revved up, to get going, and to produce the symptoms and then the illness, which can range from mild to severe to death. And what happens is that for viruses that have long incubation periods, like measles, the first immunity can come from either a vaccine, hopefully, or from an infection. And then there are two kinds of immune cells produced. One produces antibodies, which react immediately if there's another exposure to the virus. And the other are memory cells, which last for very long periods, sometimes lifetime, which is why when you get your measles injections as a kid, you don't need them again. What happens then is that if you're immune and then exposed to the virus, there's plenty of time for the memory cells to rev up and to knock off the virus. Conversely, for short incubation viruses, like the COVID virus or RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, the memory cells, once you're exposed to the virus, even if you have immunity, the memory cells don't have time to rev up. And so the virus is able to cause an illness, often a mild one, if you have prior immunity. So for a long incubation virus like measles, you can eradicate it. And we did that several years ago, or at least we thought we did, until the influx of, as you say, of immigrants.
No, I don't ever say immigrants, because immigrants come with a green card and legal permission. I call them illegal aliens, but that may not be politically correct.
Illegal aliens is fine. Aliens is fine. So it's partly due to them, as you've pointed out, but it's also made possible by the unvaccinated, by these pockets of people for philosophical reasons or religious reasons or ignorance reasons just won't be vaccinated against measles, the most communicable virus that causes preventable disease.
And that's measles, for example. I mean, my shot from more than 50 years ago is still active, according to the tests that my doctor gave me and said, yeah, you're still immune to measles, even though a long time has gone by. Why is it we can't get the rest of those vaccinations to be as long-lasting?
Well, because the virus gets a vote. It's the virus that has the long incubation period for measles. And therefore, the memory cells have time to rev up and knock it off. It's not true for the short incubation time viruses. I also want to make a point about endemic versus pandemic, because there's a lot of confusion about that. During the height of the pandemic, we said, we're hoping, we're expecting that eventually we're going to get to a time when the virus is endemic. And that's sort of where we are now with the COVID virus, that endemic is a constant presence in the community, that it's constantly there, but it's inconsistent and somewhat unpredictable, especially as the virus...
Like the flu, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Because the virus mutates, and it's a short incubation virus. pandemic occurs when the virus is spreading out of control and stressing the healthcare system and so on. And again, that's often due to mutation, evolution of the virus that makes it resistant to immunity from either vaccines or from prior infections.
Now, maybe you already effectively answered this, Henry, but why is it measles is such a stupid virus? I mean, a smart virus tries to stay alive, or I realize that technically viruses are not even alive. They're like, in some ways, they're like a little machine. But having said that, the measles virus seems like an exceptionally stupid virus in that it doesn't mutate, which means you get a shot 50 years ago and it still works today. And the smart viruses are the ones who say, let's give them a new version every year, like the fashion industry or something.
Well, I'll tell you, the smart thing for viruses to do is to spread. That's their telos. That's their goal in life, Darwinian selection. What they don't want to do is to kill their hosts rapidly.
Right.
Because then they don't.
That would be Ebola, right? That kills the host so relatively rapidly that it quickly burns out. Right.
Exactly. And that's why we don't have pandemics of Ebola, because it can't spread rapidly. It's not highly infectious and it's not airborne, whereas measles and COVID virus are. So, the viruses are not as smart in the sense of that mammals can be, but they obey the rules of Darwinian evolution, which is to survive, the fittest survive.
That's Dr. Henry Miller, molecular biologist now at the American Council on Science and Health. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Summertime is...
The voice of the people. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. And I got a question to start you off. Should a governor, any governor, use your tax money to promote a failing government carbon tax program that goes to the voters for them to decide whether it lives or dies this November? Now, the fact is, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand that it's wrong for the government to use your money, your tax money, even if it was collected through this crazy carbon tax program that I hate. It costs me money. It costs you money if you live in Washington State or buy fuel in Washington State. It costs you money. And now Jay Inslee apparently is using some of that money to promote the program so that voters will not vote it down when it gets on the polls through Initiative 2117 this November. I thought we'd talk about, though, with Todd Myers, who's the environmental director at Washington Policy. Todd, welcome back to the program.
Always nice to chat with you.
Have I mischaracterized any of that?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it. Yeah, so this November, Washington voters will vote on a carbon tax, a CO2 tax, called the Climate Commitment Act, which was adopted in 2021 and went into effect last year. And we've talked about this before, that it's driving gas prices up. Well, now that it's on the ballot, Governor Inslee and the supporters of the climate law are nervous. So they have put up a webpage paid for by state taxpayers as part of the governor's office, with a logo for the Climate Commitment Act, and they are requiring any jurisdiction or agency or anyone else who receives money from that CO2 tax to include the logo and include language talking about how the Climate Commitment Act is reducing CO2 emissions, creating jobs, and improving public health. So it is clearly a political effort to support the law. And I can tell you that I've worked with government programs a long time. I don't think I've ever seen one have a, you know, custom-made logo that agencies were required to use.
Well, and let me ask you a couple of things. Let's just start with the easy one. Can he legally do that?
You know what? I am not a lawyer, so that's actually not easy for me. I am less concerned. You know, theoretically, I suppose he might be able to argue that, yes, he could do it. But I still think it's wrong.
Well, I think it's wrong as well, especially when he's using an economic lever on agencies that are within his executive branch to say, you will use it because you get money from the program. So if you don't use it, maybe you won't get as much money from the program. So this is the governor who can decide, I'm going to make you do this, and I don't have any law that backs me up. And I told you, Todd, it kind of, I'm not a lawyer either, thank God, but there's a thing called the Hatch Act at the federal level, and it does apply to some state officials. In fact, in looking it up again this morning, like I did, because I'm not a lawyer, the Hatch Act applies to any government agency at the federal level, but it also applies at the state level if those state agencies take federal money. Well, that describes just about every state agency in Washington State. Last time I checked, they all get federal money. So if they've got federal money, the Hatch Act in simple terms says you can't go out and do campaign-related activities on the public's dime, on the public's time. It means that somebody like Karine Jean-Pierre, you know, Joe Biden's spokesperson, who doesn't exactly do a great job, but she's not allowed to do campaign stuff. And sometimes she'll wave a question off saying, look, that's about the campaign. I can't touch that. There's a legal reason she does that, because she's not allowed to do that. Now, if you say, well, why can Joe Biden do it? Why could Jay Inslee do it? The elected officials themselves are allowed to go out and advocate for anything they want because they're elected officials. What they can't do is tell our employees, the ones who are taking a paycheck paid by our tax dollars as employees of the agency, they can't go out and campaign. So, for instance, go ahead.
I was going to say it's even worse than that, because you've mentioned state agencies, and state agencies obviously have to use this logo and this language. But it's beyond that, which is that local jurisdictions cities and other folks also have to do the same thing. So in the particular case, and so I have a blog about this at washingtonpolicy.org, they sent out an email to a city government saying you have to do climate planning, growth management planning for climate change required by law, but we will pay for that planning. But since we're paying you to do the planning, you have to use this logo and language. So it's not just state agencies that are forced to use this logo and language. It is any jurisdiction or anybody else who receives money from the state.
So that means cities, counties, and all the rest of that. And tell me this. They had a stack of claims. They said, well, this is making jobs. It's making the environment healthier. It's making the air cleaner. Todd, is there any indication that any of this money that was scooped up, the much bigger amount than they thought they were going to scoop up with this carbon tax, is now in the billions of dollars? Is there any indication that that money has done any of those things?
Well, the first round of payments, which in terms of the government, in terms of the state budget, which were, you know, set out last year, we looked at those and we found that the majority of the funding went to expanding government. So exactly like the program that I just talked, which is requiring governments, local governments, to do more government planning for climate change. Well, okay, so maybe it created a new job, but it created a new government job. It didn't create a job in the business sector, in the private sector. And in fact, what we see is the opposite, which is we just saw a hydrogen company close down in Spokane. And if you look at a map nationwide of where so-called clean energy businesses are going, they're not coming to Washington. They're going to the Southeast United States. Why? Because that's where the business climate is good. So if you count government jobs, they probably are creating some jobs, but they're not creating private sector jobs.
What about the healthy part of it, saying we've made Washington State healthier by this money? Is there any indication that's actually happening?
I think the game that they play is that they classify a lot of things as healthier that may or may not be. But as we've pointed out in the past, they spend a lot of money on programs that they say this is designed to reduce CO2 emissions or recover salmon or improve health. But then you look at the actual outcomes, and the outcomes aren't there. So, no, I think if you look at outcomes, is Washington State healthier this year than it was last year? I don't think there's any evidence of that, certainly not from the programs that they funded.
So we should plan on them spending more tax money between now and November to try to defeat a ballot measure that would take the Climate Commitment Act and do away with it altogether.
Yeah, and two things specifically. One, which is this isn't the only example of this. The legislature also allocated $150 million to go out to people in $200 checks 2 months before the election, likely with a letter, and the letter hasn't been, but initially the draft was to say, thanks to the Climate Commitment Act, you are getting this utility rebate.
They're buying votes.
I will say that people are very clever, and so when I tweeted this out yesterday about this program, somebody said, you know what, we should print up this logo and put it on gas pumps and say, these prices brought to you by the Climate Commitment Act. So
I think that's a brilliant idea. That's Todd Myers, Environmental Director at Washington Policy. In a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson Show. You can't fix stupid.
Stupid is forever.
But you surely can vote them out. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. I want to get to something a whole lot more pedestrian, and that is social media and the threat that it poses to your children, a threat that we probably wouldn't have even realized maybe even 20 years ago, to say if your kid has a smartphone, that this might be a device that is used to put things in front of your child that are absolutely inappropriate, potentially even damaging, and even allowing perverts and pedophiles to reach out to your children inside your own home. So maybe there should be some limits. Well, Florida has now put a limit on it, saying children under the age of 14 cannot create a social media account in the state. Now, that bill takes effect January of next year. It gives parents a greater ability to protect their children. And it does raise the question, what is the youngest age that somebody should be in order to access social media? Colin Ritter joins me now, a senior research associate for EdChoice. Colin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
So you did an EdChoice survey, and you actually surveyed not parents but teenagers. What'd you find out?
Yeah, so we typically do each month we survey parents and the Gen Pop, but twice a year we survey teens and teachers, and typically those are my favorite surveys just because, especially with teens, they're so, you know, outward in their opinion, and they're very brutally honest, which is something to appreciate, especially as a researcher trying to get at what they're seeing every day in their school. You mentioned the Florida bill. Teens are actually pretty close to agreeing with that. They think there's a good portion, about a third of teens say that you should be at least 14 to be able to access social media. So they're in agreement there. There is, you know, two thirds of teens that think it should be younger than 14, but then 13 is kind of the age where teens are kind of split.
Let me ask you this, Colin, does that result surprise you in that, you know, most kids, if you ask them, what should you be allowed to do? I mean, I know that most of them would say, well, I should be able to do just about anything. I should be able to maybe drink a beer or, you know, drive the car or whatever. They want to be able to do more than perhaps they're mature enough to be able to do. But does it surprise you that when you ask the teens, because they know it, they're on social media, they see what it can do, both good and bad, and they say, yeah, 13 or 14 is probably about the right age. Does that surprise you that they would say that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you make a good point. Teens do kind of feel, you know, that there's that rebellious side of them. I think that they can do anything. I mean,
why can't I get a body piercing, Mom?
Exactly. And it was a little surprising. I guess I thought it would be a little younger. Teens might think that, you know, age 10 or 11 might be fine. But, yeah, I guess I was a little surprised. But then we have a follow-up question that says, you know, what kind of impact do you think social media has had on you in these following areas? And, you know, 40% of teens said that it's had a negative impact on their mental health. So while teens think that they should be able to access it at a, you know, age 13, they are also aware of the fact that it does have a negative impact. It's not just this great tool that everyone should have. There's consequences to it.
I mean, because, Colin, when I look at social media, which came about after I was already an adult, but I look at it and I think, man, I can't imagine how a kid would react to having some of this stuff put in front of him or her, you know, and maybe they'd realize, hey, this isn't really good for me, you know, and maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they'd say, hey, I like having access to all this information, even though I'm not the right age. And yet these people are the people closest to it who grew up with it. So if anybody knows, they should, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and personally for me, when I was in high school and things like that, Facebook was first, you know, gaining popularity. And for me, and I'm sure other teens feel this way as well, in that moment, it was sort of, my friend has it. I want that. So you ask your parents and it kind of spreads like wildfire at that point. So you're right. There's a little bit of that.
Let me ask you this, because one of the things that came up when this bill was passed and DeSantis said he was going to sign it, I thought, okay, well and good. How are you going to do that? Because I would imagine that there are going to be parents who say, oh, no, there shouldn't be any limit. Does that mean that parents might just go out and create the social media accounts and allow their kids to access them if they really think 14 is not the right place to put the limit?
I think parents could do that. It's relatively straightforward in the bill once you look at it. And, you know, I believe age 14 and 15, you have to get parental consent to do it. I think once age 16 hits, then it's, you know, it's free reign. You don't need a parent to sign off on it. I'm sure there will be parents who think their 12, 13-year-old will be fine to do it. Then maybe they can sign it up under their name. I don't know exactly what kind of guardrails are in place to protect from that. But I do know that this is something that they've been working on for a while, and you know, it's going to happen in January. I guess we're gonna see real quick what kind of reaction and what kind of stems from it once it's implemented.
Well, and you'd almost think that some of the social media companies would say, hey, this isn't such a bad idea. We don't like the grief that we get. And they probably rightly get grief when some 13-year-old girl becomes distraught over the things people are saying about her on social media and sadly takes her own life. I mean, social media companies you'd think would want to avoid all of that if they possibly could, or being accused of, you know, exposing kids to age inappropriate stuff, to put it politely, that they would want. And what has the reaction been from the social media companies to this new law?
You know, you would think that I want to agree as well, but I mean, we know some of the people, you know, not personally, but we know some of the personalities in charge of these things, and I'm not sure if, you know, limiting and kind of impacting the bottom line and saying who can and can't use the social media is totally something they're in love with. I don't know. I don't have off the top of my head exactly what the response has been. I know that this has been coming for a while, and especially with everything that's gone on with TikTok, you know, like kind of mitigating the impact of social media on minors has been such a hot topic for quite a while that you would think that eventually they would have to succumb to the status quo. It's like, yes, this is, you know, there is stuff on here that 10, 11, 12-year-olds shouldn't be accessing, and there needs to be some sort of system in place, you know, how that is implemented, who that's implemented by, whether it's federal or at the state level. In this case, it's at the state level. I would love to see what the general public and parents would say about it, but I'd assume it's generally a favorable feeling.
I mean, and when you talk about the commercial value and having them worried about their bottom line, I'm not exactly sure that 12-year-olds are the biggest consumers in America, maybe of toys or some clothing, but for the most part, they're not buying cars, they're not taking out mortgages. You know, I wouldn't worry about them until they actually have the ability to make some money and spend it. At 14, I'm not even sure how many parents allow their 14-year-old, hey, go ahead, get on Amazon, order anything you want. In fact, we've seen famous crash and burns when that happens, and the kid orders $6,000 worth of something off of Amazon, and it doesn't work out well for mom or dad because they're on the hook.
Correct. Yeah. No. And I don't think that they're exactly worried about like actual profit. But I mean, in terms of just the general number and you know quantity of accounts made and things like that, that's something you can sell to advertisers or people trying to you know advertise on the website, and they say, hey, look, we have you know X amount of new users. We have X amount. You know, companies are looking for to get into younger markets, things like that. It's like, okay, we have this amount of you know kids in high school, things like that. So. I think you're right. It's probably being a little dramatic worrying about the bottom line. But, I mean,
I'm headed up to a break. Tell my audience where they can find the results of the EdChoice survey, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is edchoice.morningconsoleintelligence.com. That's a subset of our normal website, edchoice.org. But we have monthly surveys of the general population of parents. We have semi-annual surveys of teachers and teenagers as well. And, we love any sort of feedback.
It's fascinating data. That's Colin Ritter, who's a senior research associate at EdChoice. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. John Kennedy gets it.
Mr. President, you just got to try harder not to suck.
Well said, Mr. Kennedy. We agree. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I told you earlier in the show today that Joe Biden is pulling out all the stops. He wants to get votes any way he can get them. Pay off your student loans, whatever it happens to be. Put Donald Trump in jail. And now he's going after the marijuana vote. And he did something today, and I'm not going to display my ignorance on this, but I want to ask Luke Nefratos, who joins us now, Executive Vice President of Smart Approaches to Marijuana, otherwise known as SAM. Luke, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me on. Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well. And by the way, I'm not a fan of marijuana. Don't like it. Tried it a couple of times in high school. Tried it a couple of times in college. I thought it was a dumb drug. I still think it's a dumb drug. I think it makes people psychotic. It's got a lot of other problems associated with it. Just so my audience knows where I'm coming from. I'm not a fan. But when states have said we're going to legalize it for medical use, for recreational use, okay, I respect the right of states to make their lives. The federal government still makes it illegal. It's on Schedule 1. And if I understand correctly, what Joe Biden announced literally just a few hours ago, the administration said, we're going to move marijuana, which is currently on Schedule 1 for medical uses, to Schedule 3. And my first question was, can they legally change the designation of a drug from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 without going to the U.S. Congress?
Yes, they can. So they have the basically anyone can actually initiate a scheduling review. Literally any American citizen can petition the DEA to do a scheduling review of any drug. And so this has actually been done multiple times. In 2016, the Obama administration did a review of marijuana scheduling status, and they concluded that it should remain in Schedule 1, interestingly enough, under
Obama.
Yeah,
because Obama literally said it was dangerous, right?
Yes. He said it was dangerous, it's getting more addictive, it's getting more harmful, and so now, you know, here in 2024, it's even worse. We're seeing people going psychotic, we're seeing violence associated from now these high-potency marijuana products, we're seeing our kids get more addicted than ever in our roads. I'm from Colorado, I know you're in Oregon, so you're no stranger, but I'm from Colorado, and our roads are a nightmare with people getting stoned and driving. So this, it's literally gotten worse. This is not the time to downgrade marijuana status. By moving it to Schedule 3, they're saying it has a low potential for abuse, And if anything, we're seeing it's got a higher potential for abuse.
Doesn't it? I mean, Luke, I've had a former DA friend of mine who's deaf on this legalized marijuana nonsense. But he's not an old fuddy-duddy. He's a Democrat and all that. But he told me, he was asking treatment people, what is the number one drug that you see self-referral for? That is, people who walk in, not because the court told them to, and they say to the treatment center, I'm on this, help me get off of it. Number one is alcohol, but number two is pot, even though it's notoriously not addictive, but it isn't addictive in the same way that heroin is, but it is psychologically addictive. And apparently there are an awful lot of people who find themselves turning themselves into treatment saying, hey, help me get off this stuff. I can't quit on my own. So this is a serious problem.
That's right. This quote-unquote harmless, non-addictive little plant is also the top reason for youth addiction treatment admissions in Colorado. So number one reason for youth going into addiction treatment is
more
marijuana.
Than alcohol. It's more than booze?
More than alcohol. More than alcohol, more than anything else. It's marijuana in Colorado and a number of other states. And the reason why is, you know, this isn't the ditch weed from Woodstock days anymore. They've supercharged this drug now. It's 99% potent compared to 3% in the Woodstock days. And it's coming in vaping oils and candies, gummies, ice creams, all of that. And of course, you know, you got the big tobacco and big alcohol conglomerates that have gotten involved, and they know how to target kids. And so they're coming after the kids with, you know, there's this multi-state marijuana company called Cookies, where they literally have a cookie design. It's clearly targeting kids. And they're state legal in a bunch of different states with legal marijuana. So,
and gummies and things like that. And you know what I worry about too, Luke? As I understand it, both calls and admissions to poison centers, most states have a poison center, but the ones involving kids just tear at my heart, because I think, so you want to do pot? Fine, do pot. Well, we're going to do edibles and gummies. Okay. And you're going to have them around the house. Are you going to treat them like the pill, a bottle of prescription pills? Or are you going to leave them out where one of your kids can either deliberately take it if they're old enough and say, I want to get high too. Or if they're a little kid and they just think gummy looks yummy and put it in their mouth. And that's happening, isn't it?
That's happening at alarming levels. We just saw a study last year that there's been a more than 2,000% increase in kids under the age of 5. That are being poisoned by marijuana edibles. And, you know, I hear the libertarian argument, okay, whatever you're going to do to your own body, fine. The problem is we've known for a number of years in this country that drugs don't just stay with the person who chooses to do them. That's why they're illegal. When somebody uses drugs, it impacts their family, their kids, it impacts their community if they're driving. You know, the safety-sensitive workforce has seen a 20% increase in marijuana positivity rates in this country. That means bus drivers, school bus drivers, semi-truck drivers. Okay, so it's not an individual rights issue. When you use marijuana, that impacts the kids in the house. If you leave the gummy bears out, it impacts the community around you. If you work with anybody, which most of us do. So this is not just an individual rights situation. This is something that impacts the community, and we need to have a better understanding of that.
I'm talking to Luke Nifratos, who's executive VP at Smart Approaches to Marijuana. What's the website so people know? And then I've got a couple of other questions.
Check us out. We're the top organization on marijuana policy fighting the bad guys. Learn about SAM.org. We're trying to protect kids and families from getting addicted to today's high-potency pot.
Well, you got to check this out. Smart Approaches to Marijuana. Its executive vice president is Luke Nifratos.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. But I want to talk education with our friend Lieve Finna from the Washington Policy Center, and about something that I think is a canard. I think people are trying to sell us a line when they say, well, It's COVID that really pushed parents by the hundreds of thousands, even by the millions, to pull their kids out of public school. I think it's something more basic than that. I think parents finally got a chance to see what was being done to their kids because COVID and remote learning and all that exposed the parents to what was actually going on in the classroom that they never before had the real chance to see happening with their own eyes. And I think that's what did it. But my friend Lee may disagree with me. Lee, welcome back. What's on your mind?
Oh, I think that is definitely part of the picture here. The result of this has been a movement across the country. I call it the school choice revolution, where states are passing laws giving parents between $4,000 and $8,000 in public aid in an educate savings account or a voucher for the purpose of educating their child, and even paying the cost of private school tuition. And now this is the response from the COVID experience. Caring lawmakers in many states realized that parents needed an option to their assigned public school. And this is what they're doing. They're giving parents control over the funding and letting them direct the funding to the school that they choose for their child. It is so exciting today, Lars, the state of Louisiana, the Senate Finance Committee passed 4-3, a universal school choice bill for Louisiana. It has already passed the House, and the governor is sympathetic. So this would make Louisiana the 12th state in the nation to have universal school choice. It is just taking off like wildfire.
So we've got a quarter of the states that will give parents choice, and the rest of them are so far saying, nope, it's one size fits all. Your kids will go to a government school, and you'll simply accept the result, even if it's a bad result, which it too often is.
Yes, that's exactly the position that states like Oregon and Washington and California are in, because there have been efforts to introduce these bills in those states, and the representatives of the special interests in the public schools have blocked their movement to law. Unfortunately, some of our legislatures are not passing laws that consider the needs of the child and the family first. And of course, that's the purpose of education, is to give a quality education to every child. And the one-size-fits-all monopoly model has shown that it's not up to the challenge of emergencies like COVID. The schools were closed a full year longer than was necessary during COVID, a full year. Students were denied a full year of their education, and that population of students is being made to pay the cost of not having the learning, the academic tools they need to succeed in their future. And so it is only right and just that their families, and maybe it won't benefit the children that suffered during COVID, but it may benefit their younger brothers and sisters to get access to a school that is in line with their values, that sets a high bar for achievement, that likes the United States, for example, that teaches civics in an honest and true way.
Well, yeah, but Lee, this shows why you're so confused about what's going on. I mean, you said the purpose of government-run public schools is to benefit the kids and the parents and their communities. Well, you don't understand. The purpose of government-funded public schools is to provide jobs for unionized teachers, donations to political parties, one of them, the Democrats, and also to indoctrinate the kids so that everything their parents might try to inculcate into them in the form of values is simply overridden by the teachers they spend 6 or 8 hours a day with. That's the purpose of public schools. Now, I know the unions and the schools don't want to say that out loud, but we all know that's the real purpose. It's not about the kids. I mean, if it were about the kids, you wouldn't have teachers go on strike and throw the kids out in the cold for 2 or 3 weeks just so the teachers could get a raise and claim it's all about the kids while the kids are sitting at home not learning anything.
I agree wholeheartedly. It is wrong that the teachers union has such power over our public schools. They should not be able to close the schools at the drop of a hat. They should not be able to keep the schools closed during COVID an entire year longer than necessary. It is definitely a bad development. But your point about money is absolutely accurate. In Washington State, we spend every year $20.5 million a year, $24.5 billion with a B, billion dollars a year on public education. These are taxpayer dollars that are provided for the education of children, not for the provision of comfortable public sector jobs, not to enrich, further enrich wealthy unions. The purpose of public education is to educate children, and that is, you know, COVID has blown, you know, open what's actually going on in the schools. And I think your point is very well taken. I think that's what's driving school choice laws across the states. And it's something that even the states of Washington and Oregon and California can't ignore, because we're not islands in Washington or Oregon. We, you know, people cross borders. They have family members in other states like Louisiana and all these other states, 12 states, universal school choice in those states. People are going to be moving there to get their children access to private education. It's amazing what's happening.
We shouldn't make them do that. I mean, in the same way that there are parents who'll move from one side of the town to the other side of the town, and when their friends say, why'd you move? You know, you liked your house. You see, yeah, we wanted to get our kids into a good school. I mean, imagine the commitment of a family to say, we will sell our house, we will move across town, we'll take on additional expenses just to get our kids in a better school. If that's their commitment, and the government simply says, take what we offer you, it's one size fits all, and if you don't like it, too bad, it's the only choice you got. I hope parents revolt, and I hope they do it by going to the polls and saying, let's vote on this and let's change the law. And if the federal and state lawmakers won't change the law, then get the citizens the polls and have them change the law instead.
I think it's a disgrace that we have a system that is not making, number one, the academic learning and skills, the teaching adequately to children the skills they need to succeed in life. It is a disgrace that is not being done in so many schools.
Well,
and
let me ask you real quick, before we hit the break, mm-hmm. We got 12 states now. Does it look like this is going to grow dramatically? Are there more efforts in more places where it's likely to pass on its own to maybe get us to half of states that will offer school choice, or are we kind of held up at 12?
No. The big kahuna here is the state of Texas, which is undergoing a battle royale right now over the election of certain Republicans who were supported by the union and voted against school choice, even though the governor wants it and the legislature is in the control of the Republicans. So there's a fight, and they're throwing out those Republicans that are not in favor of school choice. They're losing their seats. And so it's being taken, just as you're talking about, in the political sphere. They are getting rid of Republicans that are not favoring school choice in Texas. And I'm hopeful that within the next year, we're going to see passage of universal school choice in Texas.
Let's hope. That's Lee Fenner from the Washington Policy Center. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Are on the line.
A reminder, you are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday, and I can tell you that in places like Everett, that there are kids who are being killed by the fentanyl scourge that has affected the whole Northwest, and literally in Oregon and Washington, thousands of people dying of overdoses from this illegal drug. I mean, it does have a few medical uses. They're very relatively limited because it's a very, very powerful drug. And so its medical use is very limited, but its illegal use, it's everywhere. You can buy the pills for almost nothing. And now we've seen, for example, in Everett, 3 infants overdosed on fentanyl in just 4 days in a single week, including a 13-month-old who died. So I've invited Washington State Senator John Braun on to talk about what might be done about this. Senator, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Lars.
So what are our possible range of options? Because it doesn't seem that Jay Inslee or the majority in Olympia want to do anything about this problem. So are we just fated to see a whole bunch of kids and a whole bunch of adults die in the next 12 months?
No, I think we are morally responsible to do something about this. And we have been working on this. We have had a bill this last session from Senator Linda Wilson that would have added exposure to fentanyl to the child endangerment law. It already includes, you know, if you expose young children to other drugs, methamphetamine, heroin, whatever, that's a felony, right? You can be charged with a crime and convicted in due time. However, fentanyl didn't exist when this law was created, so it's not in the statute. Therefore, there is no crime if you expose children to fentanyl. We ought to at the very least fix that. And I'm not saying, you know, even if you take the position that folks who are exposing children, they don't do it purposely, they're just subject to addiction. Okay, I can buy that. But we still have to do something about it. We can't let children be exposed to these dangerous drugs and sit on their hands and continue to watch this happen. We've had an explosion, not only in fentanyl use, as you mentioned earlier, but of children exposed and in some cases dying as a result of the exposure to fentanyl.
Well, is there anything wrong with saying it doesn't matter whether you deliberately expose the child or accidentally expose them? I don't imagine most drug addicts are very responsible about their drug use. I mean, that's the nature of what they're doing. They're taking an illegal drug. Why would we expect them to be, say, as responsible as a medical a doctor, a nurse, or a lab tech, or a pharmacist? They're all required by law to be responsible, but these users of illegal drugs can expose their kids. I don't have a problem with saying that's a crime, and you can't do that.
I don't have any problem at all with saying that's a crime. In fact, that's exactly what we did in the Washington State Senate this year. I mean, in this bill, just to be clear, it wasn't a partisan bill. It left the state Senate with a unanimous vote from, you know, both sides of the aisle voted for it. And then the chair of the Community Safety, Justice and Reentry Committee in the House refused to even give it a hearing, claiming that there were not a single vote, a person in the 58 Democrats in the House who would vote for the bill, therefore didn't even deserve a hearing.
In spite
of the fact that it came out of the Senate.
You know, not one?
No, that's what he claims. Very, very public claim that no one would vote for it. Therefore, it didn't deserve action. And it's a travesty. You know, the hypocrisy of naming the committee, starting with community safety, and then refusing to even hear a bill that helped that would make their implement consequences when people expose young children to fentanyl is just.
Senator, tell me this. When you go to your colleagues, I imagine you talk to your colleagues on the other side of the aisle. I end up talking to loony lefties from time to time on the show when they call in. When you say to them, what's your objection to making it a crime to expose a child to something that can either make the child extraordinarily sick, I mean emergency room sick, or even dead, what do they tell you?
It's all ideology. They won't really defend their position, but this is all wrapped up in the idea that we can't make more crimes. We can't make more restrictive criminal system. It's an effort to protect the criminals at the expense of the victims. In this case, the victims are young, often infant children. It's ideology. It's not logic. It's not an explanation. And it's an excuse for no action when action should be demanded.
Well, and when you say making a new crime, I mean, I think we could agree generically that any time and anyhow that you hurt a child is a criminal act. I mean, there's nothing you can do that physically damages a child and even puts the child at risk of dying that can't be a crime, even if somebody hasn't written it down in a law book. Can we agree to that?
Yeah, I mean, in my view, this is certainly a crime. The challenge, and if the child dies tragically, it most certainly is, and it's a crime that can be charged. But if they're just in danger, say they save them, luckily, with some sort of treatment, they can't, under the current law, they can't be charged, even though any reasonable person would look at that and say that's 100% a crime as intended by the statute. It's just fentanyl's not listed. This is a very simple straightforward. It's only the first step. Let's be clear about this. This is a step that starts to give a little bit of protection to these innocent victims. But we got a long way to go. We've talked about this before on getting our society back in the right direction when it comes to the use, abuse, the addiction of hard drugs. But what we do know is allowing there to be no consequences when people are injured or, sometimes seriously or even killed is wrong. It's wrong. We can't continue to do that and expect this problem to fix itself.
You know, Senator, maybe you'll see the connection, maybe not. This is not about drugs, but last week there was a man from the Tri-Cities who ended up blowing his own brains out after he killed his ex-wife, after he killed his 17-year-old, I would say, victim that he had met in middle school at age 11. And it sounds to me like that needs a good, hard investigation, because this is a guy who was a school cop, and he meets this 11-year-old girl. And questions were raised fairly quickly about what kind of relationship he had developed with this 11-year-old girl. And there were people, other students, who said, hey, there are Snapchats going around saying this 33, 35-year-old man was having sex with his 11 or 12-year-old girl. And the schools ended up letting him go as a school resource officer. But then when he applied for a job as a substitute teacher at another district just down the road, he got an entirely positive recommendation from his former employer. And when they investigated what he was alleged to have done, they said, oh, we never got a search warrant to demand his phone so we could see the kind of messages that he was sending to these girls. So we didn't have enough to charge him, and nothing got done. Well, guess what? That girl, now 17 years old, is dead because she was shot to death by this guy, who also shot his ex-wife in front of their 9-year-old kid. Lots of damage going around to lots. And these are all actions being done because folks in the schools don't follow the mandatory reporting law. I'd love to see you look into that one as well. That's Senator John Braun. Glad to have you on, Senator. In a moment, we got to talk about these Soros prosecutors who say they'll prosecute again, but only to help the Democrat Party during its big convention this summer in Chicago. I'll get you details, and your phone calls and emails are next on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And one of the most consequential issues that Americans should confront this year, and in fact, I think Joe Biden should be forced to confront it when he finally comes through on his recent pledge last week that he's finally acquiesced and said he will deign to debate Donald Trump, something that he'd been avoiding for months. I hope that one of the first things that President Trump brings up is Joe Biden's wide open border, created by the roughly 200 executive actions that Biden took in his first 100 days in office. That created the problem. Reverting to the Trump policies would, if not ending the problem, it would certainly severely diminish the problem of illegal crossings into America. But it is a big issue for voters, and I wanted to talk about that with Chris Klemm, who's a retired patrol chief from the Border Patrol and a partner with Americans for Prosperity. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Hey, good to be on. Thank you for bringing up this topic. It is absolutely important for all Americans to keep discussing until we get it right.
Absolutely. And Chris, I've been talking about it for close to 30 years. And I remember having producers say to me, are we going to talk illegal aliens again today? And I say, yes, we are. Well, why? It's one of the most important issues in the country. And 30 years ago is a much smaller issue. Even 10 years ago was smaller under Obama, when his Homeland Security chief said that even 1,000 crossings a day would be considered a crisis. Well, now we're at roughly 10,000 crossings a day. So we've got 10 times the level of crisis. But would you mind telling my audience what the voters say when they go out and do public opinion polls about where they view this issue?
Well, I can tell you right now, the plurality of Americans are seeing border security and immigration as a priority right now. You know, this administration, as you mentioned kind of in the intro, took it upon themselves to single-handedly almost revert everything that was what I would say a culmination of the first 25 of my 27 years as a Border Patrol agent, the last few being a chief. This wasn't President Trump's plan. This wasn't, you know, Obama or Bush plan. This was Border Patrol agents' plan. This is something we've been doing and working on for decades. In fact, our agency is about to turn 100 in May, and or this month actually. So, you know, to see a political move be done strictly out of spite because the previous administration under Trump was getting it right is dangerous. It made us vulnerable. And as you mentioned, it's been a problem for a long time, but over the last few years, this has been a global phenomenon. This is people from all over the world. 30 years ago, that was right on the cusp of when I joined. It was mainly single adult Mexican nationals, some Central Americans that were coming here looking for work, day yep. labor type stuff, farming. Now it's people from all over the world, from countries that don't like us. You know, the FBI director has testified twice in the last 6 months. Talk about how many bells and whistles he's been seeing going off. This is a national security issue. It's bigger than immigration. It's about border security. But we've got to, you know, I like to tell people, look, border security and immigration, they're not mutually exclusive. They're very related. But you can't have one without the other. You have to secure the border first and force people to come in the right way. And that includes will require Congress to kind of do some things to make some legislation to make immigration better and easier for America's benefit, but it starts with a secure border so we can keep America safe and keep the poison from coming in here and keeping the bad actors and the bad folks from getting in and let our agents do their jobs.
I'm talking to Chris Klemm, who's a retired Border Patrol chief and a partner at Americans for Prosperity. One of the things that gets to me is that there was a time where people would say, well, Lars, you're being racist when you talk about immigration. I said, well, I'm not talking about anybody's race. And they said, well, you know, it's mostly people from Mexico. And I said, yes, it is. But I remember a time when it was about 65%, as you said, Mexican nationals who are coming in. And many of them, I think, plan to come in, work, take some, you know, get some income and then head home in many cases. And that kind of reflected the old Bracero program where people would come in to do harvest and then return. Except the getting got pretty good in America, and they were able to find jobs and say, well, what if I just stay and continue to make good wages? And it doesn't have to be in agriculture. It can be in a lot of different fields. But these days, we've got, what, 140 or 150 countries that are represented in the illegal crossings in the last 3 years?
Yeah, so I was the chief patrol agent in Yuma, Arizona, a section of southwest Arizona, southeastern California, about 126 linear miles of border, approximately 950 border patrol agents that I led across five stations. Mexico and Central America rarely made my top 10 daily, if not weekly or monthly countries. I had 116 and 117 different countries in my little sector, one of nine on the southwest border. You know, I worked in El Paso as the number two there, the deputy chief, where we were the same type of numbers, 100 different countries. It has not been a Central American or a Mexico problem in as far as where they're coming from. They still come in, but not at the level that they used to. And again, it's coming from countries, and I don't like to broad brush any country, but when you have people like 24,000 illegal Chinese coming in last year, and we've already topped that, and we're only 6-7 months into the fiscal year, that's a problem. And it is not racist. It's not xenophobic to have a secure border. We welcome lawful immigration for the betterment yep. of our country, for our agriculture, for our economy. And we also want to help out those that have to flee for the right reasons, whether it's a refuge for war or they're being persecuted because of a protected class. But there is a right way to do it. Coming in illegally, jamming up the system, and having an administration continue to allow that to occur is wrong for the migrants. It's wrong for the border communities. It's wrong for agents, and it's wrong for America. And this administration started it on day one when he stopped the wall construction, when he stopped the halt of deportations, when he reduced detention, when he ended the migrant protection protocol, all the things that had been put in place that was making America's border safer and more economically prosperous for both countries. But most importantly, it was allowing border agents to do their jobs and keep America safe and reduce the threat. Unfortunately, the Biden administration did just the opposite.
Well, and the crazy thing is, Chris, Biden gets this insulation that no other candidate would get because he's old and somewhat demented. And I know people say, take that, you know, take it whatever way you want. But any other president who's taken the position, I don't want to do this through executive action. Well, you created the problem through executive action by taking 200 executive actions first 100 days. The Congress didn't change a single rule. They didn't take away any of the powers of the presidency or the powers of federal law. You did all this. So the reasonable question would be, if you created the problem by erasing these things, put them back. And yet you can't demand that of Joe Biden because he gives very few interviews and nobody seems willing to press him on the question. If you could create a problem with executive action, why won't you fix the problem with executive action 180 degrees the other way?
Look, the Congress and the Supreme Court has upheld many of the authorities of the executive branch. And that is one that allows the president to do the things they do. Number one, for immigration, but for the security of this country. You're absolutely right. There were a lot of things under Obama that we did for executive action that were better for the country when it comes to security. There was a lot of things that we did under Trump, very few things actually under Trump that was executive, but they got done. However, there were a lot of things undone intentionally by this administration, mainly out of spite, to stop directions, to stop policy priorities. And in fact, there's a soundbite that's going around from Secretary Mayorkas who very, you know, very confidently bragged about he to list too many of the Trump policies that they undid. And that was his quote. It's out there on social medias where he's bragging about how they reversed everything. And now they're sitting there pointing the finger, blaming Congress needs to act. Congress needs to act. Well, you know what?
Unbelievable.
Congress could have acted.
Chris, I'm up against the break, but that's Chris Klemm from Americans for Prosperity. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
You know, with all the
E.org.
Lots of folks worry about their firearms, but Lars doesn't have to worry about Biden taking his guns. He stores them upstairs. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Big iron on
You're listening
his
to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your calls. We'll get back to calls here in just a moment, but I've mentioned to you many times that Joe Biden has literally imported millions and millions of illegal aliens. Some of them even got free airplane flights in, about 500,000. That he sprinkled around the red states of America, I think in hopes of turning them purple. And now, is he using the federal government to help him harvest the votes of all those illegal aliens? Brianna Lyman joins me now, who's the elections correspondent at The Federalist. Brianna, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I've referred generically to my audience, but they have to take my word for it. I want you to tell them about these flyers that are being posted at one of the resource centers, so-called, in Matamoros, Mexico, that are being handed out to illegal aliens and what they encourage these illegals to do.
Yeah, so these flyers are interesting. So, you know, to be clear, the Federalists, we have reached out to RCM, which is the facility, and they have not responded to us. And they have actually not responded to anybody for the people I've spoken to who've written about this. So it's not clear whether or not they were personally hanging up these flyers. But nonetheless, the Heritage Foundation, they provided video footage of those flyers being present at these facilities. And so that's concerning for two reasons. Because one, the flyers say, vote for Joe Biden, right? We need to vote for Joe Biden if we want to keep the border open. Even if RCM, this, you know, non-governmental organization, isn't the one who posted them, migrants nonetheless still see those, right? They're still getting that information, that false information. And that's why it's such a concern. And so these migrants, they see this. And, you know, when they come to the United States, to register in a federal election, we use the honor system, right? We're the most important country in the world, and we're using the honor system to verify people who can be in our elections. You just check a box. That's all you do. You check a box that says I'm a citizen, and then they say, okay, but they don't require documentary proof of citizenship. And that's one of the ways that our election system has these massive pitfalls. And if you raise that concern to Democrats, they tell you you're a conspiracy theorist or you're just an election denier. But really, you're looking at these gaps that illegal immigrants or even non-citizens who are not here illegally could exploit.
And could and do, and I'll give you an example in a moment, but Brianna, to your first point about whether RCM, the Resource Center Matamoros, is doing it themselves or allowing it to be done. Look, in my studio, I decide what hangs on the wall. If you're running an NGO and somebody comes to you and says, we'd like to post these flyers that remind illegal aliens to enter America and then vote illegally, it's the center that allows them to be on the wall. And if you allow that message there, as far as I'm concerned, that's not just a tacit, but an explicit endorsement of the message. And if the message instead said, why don't you all go home? America doesn't want you. I'm pretty sure RCM would not let you put that on the wall. And to your point about registering to vote, I've literally had elections officials, even some Republicans, say, well, we know we don't have illegal voters. And I say, how? How do you know? And they say, well, right there where you sign your name, it says, if anything you've said in this election or this voter registration is false, you're subject to a federal felony and up to 5 years in prison. I said, so the fact that it's illegal to sign it illegally is you're just trusting that they're looking at that and signing it. So it must be true, which is like saying, nobody's shooting heroin in America. Nobody's smoking fentanyl because it's illegal to do that. Well, yes, it is illegal to do that, and lots of people are doing it anyway. So it's happening right now, and I think Joe Biden and the Democrats are counting on those votes.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting if you think of the federal registration form. And now this is what Mike Johnson and Donald Trump spoke about on Friday, and the media tore them to shreds about it, which is ridiculous, but you expect that. But if you look at a state like Arizona, so back in 2013, the Supreme Court issued a ruling, and what they said is that you can't violate the 1993 National Voting Rights Act. And what they meant by that was you cannot require documentary proof of citizenship to register any federal election. Now, what Arizona did is they said, okay, well, we could still require documentary proof of citizenship for a state election. So they began doing it, right, because they had referendums on the ballot. People wanted people to prove they were a citizen, and rightfully so. Arizona is a border state. And if you look at the data, in 2020, Joe Biden won Arizona by 10,457 votes.
Yep.
11,600 voters voted using a federal-only ballot, meaning they clearly weren't able to, they couldn't be verified to use a state-only ballot. And you have to wonder why. Was it because 11,600 people weren't providing proof of their citizenship in a border state that Joe Biden narrowly won? Right. That's the question that should be asked, and that's a possibility for 2024.
Yeah, it is. And I'll give you one from my neck of the woods, Brianna. I live in Washington State, in a place called Clark County. They caught a woman who said, yes, she admitted, I am a foreign national. I've lived in America. She is a green card foreign national, but she's living here legally. And she said, yes, I registered to vote. And when the prosecutor approached her to do an investigation because somebody had outed her, she said, yeah, I'm a foreign national. Yes, I'm a green card holder. Yes, I know I'm not allowed to register to vote. Yes, I did register to vote. And yes, I voted in six elections. And you know what? The prosecutor said, we're not going to prosecute her. And I thought, hold on. You got somebody confessing to a crime. And they've admitted that they knowingly broke the law. And still in all, depending on the politics of the prosecutor, they're not going to do anything about it. And that sends a message to everybody else. Well, she did it, and she admitted she did it, and she got away with it. Why shouldn't I do it?
Yeah, I mean, that literally ties back to what you just mentioned about some Republicans you've spoken to who said, well, it's illegal, so it clearly can't be happening. And it's like, well, it happens, people admit to it, and then people just turn a blind eye. And, you know, you gotta even cut these immigrants and these non-citizens slack, because here's the thing. They come to the United States, and they may not realize that they're even being registered to vote, because some DMVs automatically register to vote, right? There could be glitches in the system, especially states like New York, Connecticut, where you can get a driver's license even though you're here illegally.
That is brilliant. Brianna Lyman from the Federalist.com.